Welcome to Out There with TJ Ryan. It's strange. It's unusual. It's mysterious. It's out there, out there, out there, out there. And now your host, TJ Ryan.
Thanks for joining me on another show. This week I have, well, you know, I've heard about this before, and I have to thank somebody who's become a friend over the last couple of years who's been letting me know about different things, but he said there was an incident that happened right in my own backyard in Upper Michigan, and it took place at a Kinross Air Force Base. They call it the Kinross Incident, and I tried to contact somebody to talk about it initially, and this individual never got back with me. Well, then this friend of mine told me about a fellow by the name of Gord Heath. And I don't know how he found Gord. Maybe he Googled him. But I got a hold of Gord Heath, and he lives in Surrey, British Columbia. How you doing, Gord?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And thanks for coming on the show. You are a person who studied this so-called Kinross incident for quite a while.
Yes, that's right. I've been studying it since about the year 2000-2001.
And we're going to have a second segment to this show, which will, well, you're going to understand some things or maybe realize some things that are... what we're going to do is, first of all, tell you about this incident that took place back in 1953, and we look at it every different way we can. And then in the second... Part two, next week, well, we got a bit more to add to the show. And some of you maybe will stay on board because this, to me, is really interesting. Really, really interesting what Gord has to say. Gord, can you tell me a little bit about yourself, where you live and all that?
Yes, I'm a computer systems type person. Done a lot of programming. I used to do a lot of industrial control systems. I live now, I've been living here in British Columbia on the West Coast since 1986 approximately, and I was born in Thunder Bay, moved out west to Alberta when I was 6 years old, and so that's sort of where I did most of my schooling.
Now you spent some time in Upper Michigan as well, right?
Yes, on some traveling up there. Relating to some of the studies back on this investigation.
There is a lot to this story. When you started telling me that, it's just amazing, especially your involvement. I mean, is this something that you think is just continuing the rest of your life?
Well, it has somewhat subsided a bit over the last little while. For a while, I was very, very much involved in doing research into this, and I sort of feel at this point there's not an awful lot of new information that seems to be bubbling to the surface.
Right.
Plus, there is a challenge now facing what you happened with a lot of UFO-related incidents from the 1950s, is that the primary witnesses are oftentimes no longer with us.
Mm-hmm.
They pass on.
Yep.
So that's one of the things that we're now facing with the Kinross incident.
Well, we're going to describe the Kinross incident and tell you what happened and maybe the Air Force's stance and what they believed happened and speculation. And then in part two, like I said, we're going to tell you why that Gord is involved in this, why he's connected. It's really a fascinating. I hope people view it as fascinating, Gord. The Kinross incident... This happened when and what happened?
It was November 23rd, 1953.
Okay.
What we have is the Kinross Air Force Base, Northern Michigan. There was the regular crews from Kinross that actually were at that time doing training down in Yuma, Arizona. So they had brought in replacement, what they call, temporary type crews from the Truax Field in Madison, Wisconsin. So all the people who were that night on alert were all from the 433rd Fighter Interceptor Squadron. And they had been in Kinross for about 2 weeks. It was actually just a day or two before they were supposed to return to Madison.
Okay, so they were up there, and then what happened? What actually happened during the incident?
Well, the basics of the incident, just taking it down to the simplest details, is there was one F-89 scrambled from Kinross Air Force Base by one of the radar stations. They were sent up to intercept an unknown, a bogey, on radar. They flew out over Lake Superior for about 40 minutes. And this was like about 5:22 in the evening. And then they got out into the middle of the lake. They were being guided right up to the to merge with the aircraft to identify it.
They were being guided by radar back on land, you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and they were observed. The last few minutes of the intercept, the last 5 minutes, there was no radio communication back from the pilot.
This is an F-89, and who were the two pilot? The pilot, and you said there was a radar observer as well.
Yes, the pilot was First Lieutenant Felix Eugene Moncla Jr., and the radar observer was Second Lieutenant Robert L. Wilson.
Okay, so they were being guided to this point of something that was on radar. Something was there, unknown craft, and they didn't know at the time it could have been like a foreign craft, and I'm guessing they were concerned because over Lake Superior is like the international boundary. You could have somebody coming in from another country, and I'm sure that's why we protect our borders like that. So what happened next?
Well, the F-89 was observed to merge with the other bogey, and for a few minutes they thought, well, that was just maybe flying because it didn't separate again. They thought it was maybe flying in formation with the bogey.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that would, but then they never did see the F-89 appear again, and they lost the IFF signal from the F-89. Right at that point also.
Now, IFF signal is what? What is that?
It's a separate signal which actually originates from the aircraft, which identifies it as a U.S.-friendly type aircraft.
Okay.
It was a primitive system of aircraft identification, which is still used now in a much more advanced form today to identify every airplane that's out there in the air.
Okay. So they, you said, eventually lost complete signal of this F-89. And
yeah, they lost the radar return, which is just the bounce signal from the radar, plus the IFF signal about the same time.
So does that make them think this plane went down, this jet?
Well, the other thing is they are monitoring it on an altitude radar also. So they know the... they know the altitude of both aircraft, the one that it's intercepting, and the one and the F-89.
Do you know what the altitude was on that?
They were about 7,000 feet.
So just over, just less than a couple miles, mile and a half or so.
Yeah, it's about a mile and a half or something.
And so this happened.
I mean, they should have. So like they should have been able to see the F-89. Dropping in altitude. That is one of the mysteries of this.
I see. I see what you're saying. So, yeah, if that ran into this, whatever this was, then and it was going to crash in the water, then you should have been able to pick that up at least, right?
Yeah, and keep in mind that radar systems that they, in both cases, the one which is doing the distance radar, the one that is used to identify its position, it does a scan every, let's say, 5 seconds. So you don't get a continuous readout, right?
Right.
And the same is true with the height altitude radar. You get periodic updates on it. So every few seconds, you would get a new reading on the from the aircraft.
Gord, would it be possible, Gord, if these two vehicles, whatever they were, ran into each other, the F-89 and whatever was out there, and there was an explosion, that maybe that's why they didn't pick up anything?
That was actually one of the theories that was advanced. In fact, originally, the response from the Air Force, one of the theories from the base commander, that what he was telling the people in Madison was that he thought that the F-89 had perhaps banked when it was doing the intercept and lost control and dove into the lake. Mm. Whereas later, someone came and told the widow of the pilot that they thought that the aircraft had exploded in midair. But one of the things is if in almost all conditions, if you actually had a plane which had exploded in midair, you would actually get a much larger radar signature, because all the surfaces from the aircraft are now, like, you get a lot of flat surfaces.
Mm-hmm.
If it's fragmenting,
right,
and you actually would get you would see that very clearly on the radar, rather than it disappearing off. It's very unlikely it would disappear off radar if it exploded, unless it was just completely annihilated.
So then this disappears. What happens after that?
Well, they, of course, sent up F-89s to look for it. They had another three F-89s at the base that went up to look for the trying to get contact with the F-89. They were actually continually trying to reach it on radio. But as I mentioned, there was the ground control was unable to get any connection with radio from them for even the last 5 minutes of the intercept. They were guiding them to the location of the intercept, but they didn't get a response back.
Now, normally they would get a response. I mean,
there is a reason why they might not. One is that the radar observer actually has, because he has a radar his own, he might be guiding the pilot. And they actually have on the radio, they actually have some sort of a kill switch.
Okay.
That prevents the radar observer and other communications from the F-89 if they want it to be silenced, just to prevent distraction, right?
Okay. So they sent up these other F-89s to try to find Lieutenant Moncla and Robert Wilson, and nothing is ever found, right?
Yeah, that's right. What actually happens, one of the odd anomalies of this is that the first one which was sent up was an F-89 flown by Lieutenant Mingenbuck. And he actually heard, this was about 40 minutes after the F-89 had disappeared, he heard what he thought was quite certain was the voice of the pilot, Lieutenant Moncla, on radio. And he said it just sounded like an accidental transmission.
Really?
Yes. So this is part of his testimony. There was quite a bit of questioning. He made a statement. He mentioned this in his statement. And then when he appeared before the Accident Investigation Board, they had a lot of questions for him about that, what he heard and when he heard it and all that, and why he thought it was the pilot, Moncla. And the reason why he said that he was able to recognize about 80% of the people who were on his squadron by voice on radio. And he, in particular, he pointed out that Moncla spoke with Southern Drawl, and that he tended to speak quite slowly. Mm. So, and also very even tone, no sense of distress or whatever in his voice.
Well, we have to take a break, and we're going to continue talking to my guest this week. His name is Gord Heath, and he is talking to me from Surrey, British Columbia, and we'll continue talking about the Kinross incident. Out there. I've lived up here probably, when I think about it, most of my life with the exception of about 3 or 4 years in Upper Michigan. I grew up in Norway, Michigan. I live now in a place not far from Escanaba out in the country. And Escanaba, Michigan's right on Lake Michigan. The area we're talking about, the Kinross, is up near Sault Ste. Marie, which is near the Canadian border, near the Sioux Logs. And now it's called Kinchelow. And as I went online and looked at this, this incident was actually, it was a very mysterious incident. And it probably would have faded away into oblivion had it not been for Major Kehoe. Now, Major Kehoe, who started out as a skeptic, became a believer. And here's a guy that was a former major in the Marines. So that makes you wonder why he would change his tune. And then on top of that, this thing was never fully explained, as we're going to explain in this interview. There was a reason given to what the radar, what they picked up on radar, what they thought it could have been. There was the official version. But, thanks to my guest, he was able to prove that that wasn't necessarily true. And then as we step back and next week go into the second part of this, you're going to find out something that I think that is just going to be, unless you've heard this before, I never have. I've heard about abductions. I've heard about people being taken. I believe that goes on. But this goes way beyond that. And I don't want to lean into it too much right now. We just want to get the facts out. I hope you can accept at least this part of it. And it's up to you. But next week, you might get blown away a little bit. It certainly did. It's just incredible. An incredible story. And we'll just present it. And you can take it wherever you want after that. But it's really a joy to talk to Gord Heath, a man from British Columbia, who I think has probably had some difficulties trying to understand all of what's gone on in his life. And I give him credit for being on my show to talk about it. He hasn't done a lot of interviews. They did a documentary in Canada about him. He's been on, I saw him on other web interviews, but not actual broadcasts or podcasts. And he told me he doesn't even know if he'd want to go on some of those. So I'm just glad he's willing to share it with me, and maybe you'll gain something from it. Thanks for listening.
It's out there, out there, out there, out there.
You're listening to Out There. My name is TJ Ryan. My guest is Gord Heath. Now, I'm doing this interview in a different room. So normally I can just talk to a person and I don't have to adjust the controls. But if I bring him up too far, it's going to feed back. I did get rid of the buzz, though, Gord. Can you hear me?
That's good.
Yeah, see, I'm going to keep him down a little bit for now. He's out of Surrey, British Columbia. And you were born in 1954. Is that correct?
That's right.
So you're just a little bit old.
1954.
You were born a little bit before I was. I was born in 1960. And anybody born in that time period obviously is brilliant. Thank you. But
has seen a lot of things pass by in history.
Yeah.
In pop culture.
So now we're going to talk about this F-89 with Eugene Moncla and Robert Wilson disappears. What is the explanation that comes officially from the Air Force?
The explanation that you get in the U.S. Air Force report is that they claim that the reason why they were sent up to intercept was they'd actually found this track, on radar, and they already knew what the aircraft was. That was this RCAF C-47, but it seemed to be flying, from what they said, it was flying 30 miles off course. So they thought it was the C-47 because obviously it wasn't where it was maybe supposed to be, according to what they're saying. So that was the official explanation, that it was flying. And this C-47 actually was flying eastward from, it had originated that day from Winnipeg, had flown to Thunder Bay, was on its way across Lake Superior to Sault Ste. Marie, and on towards its final destination, which was Rockcliffe Air Force Base in Ottawa, Ontario. So the part about the RCAF C-47 heading out over the lake, that part is certainly feasible.
And that's Royal Canadian Air Force, right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
And but one of the problems with the claim is that I was able to locate the pilot of this plane. I found out the plane itself, they provided an identification for it,
mm-hmm.
which was VC-912, and I found out that aircraft had been with the 412 Squadron. And I was able to obtain from Canadian archive records of the squadron that who was actually flying that flight. And I was able to obtain by sending out a lot of letters, because the name was not a very common name, I was able to locate the pilot, and he indicated that he most certainly was not flying off course that night.
No kidding.
Plus, the fact is that if you look at where the intercept was located, they actually should have been flying 30 miles south of that location, the C-47, because it's flying directly from Thunder Bay over to Sault Ste. Marie, whereas the F-89 was actually, 30 miles north of that track when it disappeared.
So now we know it's not that, right?
Yeah, and plus there's a lot of reasons why that indicate that was sort of just an excuse, that they didn't really want to. It was convenient to have to use that C-47 as an explanation, is what it appears to be the case,
mm-hmm.
that there was some other aircraft or whatever that they were actually intercepting.
And they weren't about to tell us, right?
Yeah. They actually, not only were they not about to tell you, it was against regulations to tell the public about anything which was an unidentified UFO-type activity.
I've always wondered, and I talk about this, and we're going to talk about this next week. What gets somebody so motivated to follow an incident that took place, a long time ago? And you started, really looking into this, you said, in 2000-ish, around there. And, you remind me a lot of Frank Fischino, because he has been on my show before, and he really took a passion for the Flatwoods Monster incident that took place back in the 50s. And, it always makes you wonder, why would somebody, unless they've had their own, have you had unusual experiences? And we're not talking about, have you seen a UFO in your lifetime?
Oh, yes, I have seen a few of them.
And were they fairly close up?
I would say, one of the things is that a lot of UFOs that people see are ones at night, where it's quite possible, unless it's something that's extreme close, that you never really know whether it's quite possibly something else, because anything that's just a light in the sky is...
Right. I agree with you.
Quite questionable.
Absolutely.
But I did see one couple during the day. In one case, I saw one which was very, very clear and was able to observe for about 5 minutes.
No kidding. Now, you were telling me when we talked the other night that was it your mother that had an experience really unusual?
Yes, when she was just like, I guess... about 6 years old, was a child living on a farm in northern Saskatchewan. And she remembered seeing what she called little green men, but she used the term little green men to mean aliens.
Mm.
And she said they were, small people dressed in silvery suits with, she described them as having some sort of a helmet or a balaclava over their heads.
Hmm. So it's not typical of what everybody, and maybe it's different for everybody, what people see, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, what was interesting about her sighting, I did some research into Saskatchewan sightings, and I found out that there was one from that period of time that really matched her observation, although it was a different location, up near... a lake further northeast of where she was living. And that the year was 1933, which matches up with about the time that she saw her sighting. And it's quite an interesting report.
Back then they couldn't probably say, well, it's a government experimental craft. Probably not so much back then.
No. Even now we don't have we don't really have, the only flying saucers that have ever been built have been ones that have not really flown at all. The craft was seen out in the Muskeg near this lake in northern Saskatchewan. Mm. They saw these little people who were, seemed to be, they were repairing the craft or something. Mm. That seemed to be the indication of what they were doing.
Now, as we get back to the Kid Ross incident, and what you said started to give it some credibility as far as UFO researchers, was a report or an account by Major Kehoe. I've heard the name before. Can you tell me a little bit about him?
Yeah, he was he was a major in the Marines. He had learned to be a pilot with the Marines. And after being in the, I think he was in an accident where he was injured, he took up writing, and he started doing an awful lot of aviation writing, was doing a lot of aviation writing for Look magazine, I believe it was, and ended up being asked to do write an article on UFOs, and at first he was quite skeptical about it, but he ended up meeting a lot of pilots and military pilots and civilian pilots who were giving him very detailed accounts of encounters they were having at that time. So he turned out to be quite a believer that there was something behind the UFO phenomenon, possibly something extraterrestrial. And he became quite dedicated to trying to get the information, getting the military to release the information they had about it to the people. So he wrote in a book in 1955 about this. What happened to him is he actually was woken up the night of the incident by a friend of his who called him up. He was living in Washington, D.C. at that time, and was woken up, and this friend of his told him that that there had been rumors out at Selfridge Field near Detroit there. Mm-hmm. That an F-89 from Kinross was hit by a flying saucer.
Wow.
And he says, all I know is that the plane is missing. So that's how he was told about the incident. So it started right off from the first phone call he got. That was the information that he received, that this was in some way a UFO incident.
And so,
and what's interesting about this is that is the only real key piece of information that really tells you that this was anything other than some sort of conventional accident, right?
Right.
We don't know what the other aircraft was, and it's only this statement that he makes that he got from this friend of his that identifies this as a UFO. So we don't know even what it was, why the reason why he thought it was, or why he'd been told it was possibly a flying saucer.
Yeah, why would they tell him? It was just a friend
of his. Friend of his. He was obviously someone who knew, or maybe he was in the Air Force, or in fact, I think he's indicated as being someone who had been, a former Army Air Corps navigator, whatever.
Okay. So then he publishes his account. What does he publish? What kind of, is it a magazine or a book about this kid?
Yeah, it's a book. And what happens is he follows up from this phone call. He follows up with calls to the Pentagon. He's contacting the Air Force press desk, and he talks to First Lieutenant Robert White, who gives him information, and it's in his information that he gives is quite different from the explanations that were offered by other sources from the U.S. Air Force. And in fact, he indicates that the unknown in the case was a Canadian DC-3. He told me it was over the locks by mistake. So the C-47 is basically the military version of the DC-3. However, this is different information that this plane was over the locks,
right,
at Sault Ste. Marie, which is, of course, at the very, very close to Kinross Base, which would imply that they'd gone up after the whole other story is that there was an intruder over the locks, which was restricted airspace, which is certainly a strategic defense, you know, something of defense significance
to
the U.S.
Absolutely.
So if there were an aircraft there, you would definitely want to send someone up to intercept it.
That would make a lot of sense. So whatever happened to the rest of this story, did they ever find the F-89 and Lieutenant Moncla and Robert Wilson?
No, they were all... They presumed that the F-89 had actually crashed into the lake. Now, when they did a search of the lake, they found nothing, no oil slick or anything like that, and no trace of the aircraft. But there was also accounts of people who heard a crash soon after that disappearance that night in a place like... close to Wawa, Ontario, on the eastern side of the lake. But in order for that to have ever been the F-89, the F-89 would have had to fly underneath radar. And there were actually several radar stations which were actively looking at that area of the lake because of the disappearance of the F-89.
Well, not only that, but how far would if this jet exploded or something happened to it, how far it would have been able to travel to get across the lake like that?
Well, I mean, presuming that the F-89 had actually gone below the radar, maybe they had lost track of it, you know, on their altitude radar. Maybe it encountered problems.
So it would have encountered a problem where they couldn't communicate with anybody.
Where they couldn't communicate anymore, yes, and they couldn't fly at a higher altitude or whatever. It all becomes quite unlikely.
Yeah, you think all those...
And, of course, the fact that there were all these radar stations and none of them picked it up, right?
Absolutely. Well, we're just about out of time. Gord, is there more you want to add to it? Because we can go on a little bit longer.
Well, I could just mention the fact that there was a hoax in 2006 of people who claimed that parts were found of the... that the... F-89 was found on the bottom of Lake Superior using Seiscan sonar. It turned out that it was claimed that this was a dive company, and the dive company didn't even exist. So it was someone who just basically perpetrated a hoax on the internet.
Mm. That's unfortunate when people do that. Now, and I'm glad to see that you've tried to find as many different answers for what went on there. Instead of just, some people right away will say UFO or whatever. You look at different options. Coming up in next week's show, we're going to tell you why Gord Heath is involved in this. And it's going to be something that is probably going to blow you away. When I heard it... To be honest with you, Gord, it really, really blew me away. But I'm open to all kinds of things. And the story is going to be remarkable. And maybe it's going to put some answers to, what really became of these individuals that were in F-89 in 1953 in the Kinross incident? And was there a UFO that was involved in all that? And also... why did someone like Mr. Heath have so many memories of things he would not know about? And that's what we're going to try to delve into next week. So, Gord, if you don't mind, we'll do this again next week.
That sounds good.
And thanks for being on this week.
Thank you very much.
So join me again next week. We're going to have part two of an interview with Gord Heath. It's the Kinross incident. And I think you're going to be really surprised in the direction we're going to go next week. Thanks for listening.
Music on Out There, created by Kevin MacLeod.